Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And this is my colleague and co-host, Sam Wong.
Hi there, Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, founder of the Princeton Election Consortium, bombing in remotely from far off Cape Cod.
So, Sam, you are really loyal. Here we are at the end of the summer, and we had to record one last podcast for the summer, and you're doing it from your vacation. You're doing it on a phone. So you definitely win our annual award that we haven't given out yet for most loyal co-host. You win.
Well, you know, I got here, and then a couple of days after I got here, then the convictions and the plea bargain for Manafort and Michael Cohen came out. And so it appears that things didn't stop while we were wherever we were. I take it you're closer to the center of Princeton.
I am. And as you just said, the news hasn't stopped. So we thought maybe we could wrap up the summer just discussing some of the high profile issues, certainly that in August have been at the center of attention. The month of August ends with Senator John McCain from Arizona passing away, one of the major figures in the Republican Party since the 1980s, and certainly just a major player in the internal battles going on within the GOP with President Trump. The news about Paul Manafort and Cohen, Michael Cohen, both at least last week were signals that there are developments moving forward with the Mueller investigation. And obviously the midterms, the next time we record, will be really underway with members campaigning and the outcome of probably one of the most significant midterms in recent history about to take place. So maybe we can discuss a little of all of that. And Senator McCain, maybe we can start with him. Obviously sad news this week that he passed away, and there's been many memorials to him. He's an interesting figure. I think people are remembering him as a maverick, and he certainly had moments when he broke with his party on issues like campaign finance reform and enhanced interrogation under George W. Bush. But he was also really a Reagan Republican. I mean, overall, he had a very conservative voting record. He was a hawk on defense, and he really was a product of that era in the 1980s when the GOP remade itself on the national stage. And I don't know, Sam, if you've been able to follow this at all from your luxurious resort in Cape Cod, but it's kind of interesting just watching the coverage and the memorials, trying to watch and listen as people figure out how do you place someone like him. On the one hand, someone who was committed to governance and committed to working out deals when possible, but also someone who was part of the changes we've been talking about in the GOP, including his selection of Governor Sarah Palin in 2008, which opened the doors to some of what we've seen under President Trump and in recent years. What are your thoughts about the senator?
Well, I think at some level, I'm going to say a couple things, some contrary things. I think obviously one should not say bad things at all about a man who lived a full life and now he's gone. But there is a sense in which people pay a lot of attention to him. He's venerated by news media, many of whom have never seen a war zone. And so there's something about him that captures the imagination. But I'm just going to say that there are ways in which he's not that different, except that his tone was emotionally warmer when dealing with the other side. And maybe that's the Reagan Republican aspect of not demonizing the other side. But if you look at things that he did, he, not to whitewash it, he voted along with his party. His party has issue stands, and he voted with those issue stands in virtually every case. There are a few notable exceptions, such as Affordable Care Act repeal. So there are certain moments when he did something really different. But if you look at his career, back in the 1980s, he looked like a lot of other Republicans. He was one of the Keating Five in the savings and loan scandal. He has had things in his personal life that don't necessarily look all that incredible compared with other politicians. So he certainly had a warm relationship with the press. He was kind as far as all reports have gone. to his opponents. But look, he's just a member of his party, and he's, as much as anyone, been dragged along with where his party has gone over the last 20 years. He picked Sarah Palin out of nowhere to become his running mate, and she ended up being a reflection of where their political party has gone towards confrontation, away from knowledge, away from the elites, in fact, having a contempt for elites. You can imagine McCain on his own, perhaps relying on experts or people on the inside. But, you know, I think a lot of his career is basically reflecting what a man like him becomes when caught in a system that has large forces at work. So I realize that that's a little bit, you know, perhaps off kilter compared with what's happening in the news media right now. But, you know, a good man with caught up in the tides of history like everyone else.
I think what's interesting, too, is, I mean, his story is the story of the Republican Party. So he's an interesting figure to think about this. And frankly, I was on air earlier today saying he would be the first person to say, take a hard look at my career and take an honest look at it. That's part of what made him very appealing. He himself talked about his imperfect record, and that's part of what he, you know, was about. And, you know, part of it was he was part of a party that changed during the course of his career. Part of it were choices that he made at the moment, like in 2008 or even the 2000 primary, that I think a lot of older Republicans, more senior Republicans, are still wrestling with, kind of compromises they made for partisan purposes that had really big long-term consequences. And so his story for me is illustrative, and it's important to kind of think about those choices because that is the path to where we are today. And he certainly ended his career, at least rhetorically, railing not only against President Trump, but often against the Tea Party and the way they conducted business. So it's actually, I think it's a useful moment for Republicans to think about where they are as in some ways the best way to commemorate some of his own struggles and some of his own decisions.
Yeah, but look, I realize that we're at a reflective moment, but I'm going to say that there are limits to what any politician appears to be able to do and survive as a Republican. So if you look at the way that the tone has changed in Washington, say from the 1980s, the way that compromise has gone by the wayside, the way that the whole thing has become an exercise in hardball politics, at some level, McCain is the most visible example of somebody who is able to make nice with the other side while being swept up by forces that make it very hard to conduct business the way it was done in the 1970s, or not the 1970s, that was a hard time, but like in the 1980s, say. So something like bipartisan tax legislation or what have you. These are times that are not really in evidence now. So it's certainly the case that he was able to make clear statements about the importance of comity and getting along. I guess I would agree that his is a voice that at least, even if he was voting along with his party, at least he made civil sounds about returning to a prior time.
And the interesting thing is, just in watching the coverage, not really about him in particular, but there is instantly this conversation that takes place, a longing for what he tried to do or represented, and we need more of them again, meaning we need more people like him. And it's the basis of the conversation we started when we started the show that, you know, both of us, I think, tend to look at the bigger forces that are pushing the political system in the direction that it has gone beyond any individual who's there or who's not there. But I think a lot of the public conversation often revolves around this longing for figures who can just transform the whole thing. If we only had more, Senator McCain's, or if we only had the next president being able to establish a civil tone. And it's really, I think it limits in some ways our capacity to actually do anything about this.
But I think that's over romanticized. I mean, I think that I think there are good men and women in Washington now. As far as I can tell, a lot of these people in everyday life are probably pretty decent. As far as I can tell, there are people on both sides of the aisle who one would not have a problem with and who one might admire personally. But they're caught up in a system, and they're caught up by political forces that reward them for being extreme. So if you look at what's happened on the Republican side, the Republican Party didn't reward John Kasich. It didn't reward other figures that we can name during the presidential process. It rewarded someone who spoke to this primal anger and elevated that to the nomination for the presidency. And so I think that it may be that McCain was able to stick with his guns in terms of public tone. But I think there's lots of people there. I think it's difficult to maintain that tone if you maintain it for a few months and then you lose your job.
And so then the next story, the next story I think that's been important, and I've certainly tried to wrap my head around what it all means, is the last week, which last week's news always seemed like it's years away, which is probably part of a dynamic that helps the president, was Paul Manafort with the convictions and Michael Cohen with his plea, was big news. It was the first real, I thought, major concrete step from the Mueller investigation into the people surrounding the president. And obviously Michael Cohen made those comments about being directed on campaign finance by President Trump. And I'm curious, I'm always back and forth. You know, part of me is suspicious that any of this investigation will have any legs, and that in the end, the Republicans won't really act on it, that the news cycle is so fast, it won't stick with the public, any of this kind of information. I'm even dubious the Democrats would do much with a stinging report. On the other hand, when I watched the news last week, it seemed that there was something to the way Mueller is in accumulating evidence, and that there could be a breaking point where the facts really start to have an impact. And some of the polls are showing more people are believing in what Mueller is doing. Where are you on all this?
You know, it's really easy to get caught up in all of these events as driving horse race and to talk about who's up and who's down. There's something refreshing about watching law enforcement at work, chipping away at a problem, and then generating a conviction or a plea bargain. And so public opinion is interesting to follow, but let's face it, most people are not following in great detail what Special Counsel Mueller is doing. And if they are, then they may, even if they are, they may view it through the lens of their own ideology or what they would like to be true. And so there's just this substantive thing that happened, which is that the former head of the FBI, the special prosecutor, has uncovered overwhelming evidence of crimes and has brought them to conviction or plea bargain. And so there's just, at this point, not any question that there's a basic storyline. In the case of Manafort, in both of these cases, these investigations have turned into concrete convictions. If you look at something like Mueller's approval rating, which it literally doesn't matter because he's not elected by anyone, it dropped about 10 points from a year and a half ago. And in the last few months, it's gone back up another 10 points. Do people follow these details? No, they don't follow these details. But what they see is that the guy apparently got a conviction. And so he's in the same category as Patrick Fitzgerald when he was investigating Blagojevich way back when. So this is a situation in which the man is doing his job and it's paying off. As far as where it'll go substantively, I mean, this is going to turn into a question of will the president of the United States pardon these people for their federal crimes? Will people, I don't know, will voters notice that we're in the midst of some kind of maelstrom where some crony of the president gets convicted for something and we're even entertaining the possibility that he'll be pardoned on the fly by his conspirator, the president of the United States? There's this weird quality of us not being, almost being unaware of what's rapidly become the new normal. So I think that the, at the core of it is this little bit of law enforcement that's just doing its job the way that the DMV does its job, the way that the grocery store does its job, the way that the guys who pick up my trash do their job. And here's Mueller doing his job. So I don't know, at some level that's kind of old-fashioned, maybe the same way that John McCain appeared to be old-fashioned.
No, that's true. That's a good comparison and a good point. And that's clearly the way, you know, Mueller, it's clearly the way that Mueller approaches his work, and part of why he has certainly not taken the bait, even with all of the president's tweets, and kept a really tight operation. In the end, there will, assuming he wants to and assuming it will be public, there will be a report. And it will be interesting because the narrative of the whole report will certainly have in terms of the potential for an impeachment process, but simply in terms of the political impact that it has on the president. And that will be a moment where we will see, and that's a little horse race fashion, what kind of an impact that kind of fact-based analysis, which will be challenged, can still have politically in the process with which we now live. Can, you know, regular order in an investigation still have the same effect, to borrow Senator McCain's phrase?
What I would generally say is that there are forces that are starting to grind away that show us which parts of American society and governmental institutions are still working normally. So at least for the time being, the FBI is working partially normally. I saw in yesterday's news, where as we record this, the House GOP has issued a panicked list of things that they say a Democratic Congress will do if Democrats retake the House in November. And it's a list of investigations that under normal conditions would sound like the normal oversight functions of Congress, looking at the president's tax returns, looking at collusion with Russia, looking at election fraud, looking at good and bad conduct in federal agencies. All these are normal oversight functions of Congress, and if voters return Democrats to controlling the House, as the numbers suggest that they probably will, all of it suggests American institutions responding finally, belatedly, to this weird 18 months that we've seen.
Wow, you're less pessimistic than you've been. You've been saying many times you're worried the institutions are broken, but it sounds like you have a little optimism now. Maybe it's being away on vacation.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. I think it's just the beach talking.
the stuff, the stories that have come out about Manafort are really incredible when you think of the role he played in the campaign. And none of this seems to be very secret. Obviously, the tax part is, but the details about the kind of business he ran and his relationship with all these governments, essentially getting people elected so that he could lobby them, which was the basis of the business, are really, it's really astounding that he was at the top of the Trump campaign during that critical period.
But these things were all known at the time. I mean, just the introduction of planks that were accommodating to Russia in the Republican platform. The fact that Manafort was involved in making contacts with these foreign powers, all of that was in the news if people were paying attention at the time. And so all this is just taking those facts and assembling them into a coherent picture in the hands of a prosecutor. And I'm not 100% sure that there's that much new information that's come out. Now it's coming from a more credible source, and it's assembled by a career prosecutor. But much of this information was known at the time. I mean, look, the guy picked Mike Pence as vice president. I mean, he's right. He's up to his eyeballs in the Trump campaign. And this is all known at the time.
And then finally, we get to the midterms. And sounds like you're feeling that the polls are suggesting the Democrats will do well. We don't know if it's a wave. We don't know if it's a small wave. But at least in the House of Representatives right now, it's looking like the possibility of Democratic control are becoming more real. And in the Senate, it seems to be much more up in the air from everything I've seen. Is that right?
Yeah, the way I would put it is this. Let's forget about probabilities because I I'm a little bit off of talking about probabilities for a while, but if we look at what it takes for either party to control the House or the Senate, just as an over-under or a golf handicap, if you will, if you look at special elections for the last year and a half, then Democrats appear to be nationally about 7 points ahead of where they need to be to retake control of the House. If you look at the generic congressional ballot, which is a softer number that's got some more uncertainty, then they're a few points ahead of where they need to be. So it looks like there's a pretty strong wave. And I will say that if we were to just to take these two data points that I just said, if we were to take them at face value, it would be within reach for Democrats to win the national popular vote by about 13 or 14 points. And that's the largest margin since 74-76, since the aftermath of Watergate. And so it looks like that there's at least a possibility of a historic national wave election on the House side. Now, you know, it could still not happen. It could end in a fizzle or a ripple. But I would say that the signs are indicating that the Democrats are on the winning side of threshold for retaking the House. And so that means they're able to overcome the gerrymandering that's been in place because they're winning.
Let me stop you right there. So you said but it could end in a fizzle or a ripple. And so as soon as you say that, people remember 2016. They remember the conversations about the polls and Hillary Clinton. So okay, given where we are right now,
let me make a ripple or a fizzle. Let me just.
Yeah.
2016 was a really close election.
Yeah.
And it was basically a near tie election. And the numbers beforehand indicated Hillary Clinton being effectively ahead by about 1 or 1.5 percentage points. And in the end, Trump pulled out a win by effectively less than a percentage point. And so there's a polling error there of about 2 percentage points. So the numbers I'm talking about here suggest that Democrats, I think that Democrats need to win the national popular vote by about 6 percentage points. And the two indicators that I'm looking at point more towards something that's more in the range of 8 to 13 points. And so it's a much larger margin than anything that happened in 2016. Still doesn't guarantee that it's going to happen, but the signs are pointing pretty clearly in the direction of a Democratic takeover of the House in a way that the closest I can... they point as clearly as Barack Obama's win in 2008 or the Republican win in 1994 when the Republicans took over Congress. And so that's the strength of which way the indicators are pointing. So, you know, sure, something could happen that that drives the storm off track. But right now, it's a really bad storm, and it's going to and it looks like it's going to encompass House Republicans.
So in terms of in terms of avoiding the storm, it would mean people would have to change their mind. Democrats, for some reason, would decide a lot of Democrats nationally they aren't going to vote. Those are the two things that could swing this beyond somehow this all being off in terms of reading where the electorate is, or otherwise interference in the election, just to throw a third thing in there.
So the most salient feature of the last year and a half, starting from about April 2017 till now, is that numbers aren't moving. If you look at Trump's approval and disapproval, that hasn't moved by more than a few points. If you look at the generic congressional ballot, it hasn't moved very much. Trump's approval minus disapproval, the fact that he's unpopular, he hasn't gotten less popular, and he also hasn't gotten more popular. If you look at the volatility of his approval rating, it's as stable as Dwight Eisenhower's approval rating in Eisenhower's first term. And that's how far back you have to go to find that level of stability in public opinion. It's just that Eisenhower was popular and stable, and Trump is unpopular and stable. And so at some level, public opinion's not moving very much. But the thing we don't know about is whether people are likely to vote. Right now, the number of people who strongly approve of him is something like 18%. And those who strongly disapprove of him is more like, I believe, in the mid-30s or maybe even higher, close to 40%. And so there's a real asymmetry in strength of approval and disapproval. And if that translates to people staying home, look, if you're lukewarm on your president, and let's say you support him, if you're lukewarm on him, then maybe you're not so enthusiastic about voting. And so I think turnout is the big question. And I think the big thing that could save Republicans would be if they can fire up their base in some way by getting them worked up about something, whether it be, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or whatever it is that they're excited about, then that could possibly save them. So I think turnout's the biggest variable at this point.
But the Senate is a different story. Even if turnout is good, it's still going to be more difficult, correct, for the Democrats to regain control.
Yeah, so as I was saying, I think that Democrats are about 7 points above threshold based on the available numbers for retaking the House. If you look at Senate polling, they're about 3 points below threshold. And so what that means is that they have to make up deficits in places like Florida, Florida, North Dakota. They have to basically win some pretty close races and rescue a candidate like Bill Nelson in Florida, who appears to be lagging slightly. And if they can basically pick up the pace by about 3 percentage points, which is pretty close, then there's a possibility that they'll have an even odds shot at taking the Senate. Now, we're talking about just a few races here, right? So if anyone were giving money to a campaign, if anyone were wanting to really move the needle on what happens next year in Washington, they should be putting their efforts into the Senate, because the Senate is a much closer proposition, and there's only about half a dozen races that are really going to determine control of the Senate. So I've been writing about this over at election.princeton.edu, and I've been writing about these close races, as I said, in places like Florida, North Dakota, and so on. And I think that very much Senate control is in the balance. Republicans are favored to retain control if they can hold 50 seats or more. But, you know, there's uncertainty, and polls can change between September and November. And there's just there's a certain animal enthusiasm that is hard to measure until it's time to actually vote.
You think in Texas, Cruz might lose?
You know, I didn't think that Beto O'Rourke had any chance at all. But I will say that that he's making that race closer than I was expecting. If you look at recent data, it looks like O'Rourke is now behind Cruz by about 1 to 5 points. And so what that means is that that it's much closer than anybody would have expected a few months ago. So, you know, it looks like Cruz is still favored to win, but it looks like O'Rourke is going to make it a close one. At least for now, that's what it looks like.
Of all the people in the campaign, but he certainly is one of the unknown persons who has really made a national profile for himself and emerged on the scene as a pretty interesting and serious player. If he does win, I would anticipate he could be a big voice in the Democratic Party in years to come. Even if it's close, I could also imagine him continuing in some capacity.
Yes, that's certainly possible, although, you know, it depends. I mean, there's, for instance, in Missouri, I believe there was a close Senate race that Jason Kander, the Democrat, didn't win a couple of years ago. So he's become a major voice, but not really a national voice. And so I guess my question there is, would losing a close race in Texas really catapult someone to national attention?
Well, the Democrats are short on younger people. It just seems like he's one of the few who has legs.
I mean, look, Kyrsten Sinema in Arizona is likely to win her race. She's a Democrat. There is some question about Phil Bredesen in Tennessee, although I guess he's not young. He's 75 years old, if I remember correctly. Jackie Rosen in Nevada. So there is a crop of, by political standards, younger politicians who are running very competitive races. O'Rourke has an exciting story because no one would have thought he could have ousted Ted Cruz as of a year ago. And so there's this rooting for the underdog quality of his campaign. So I think he naturally attracts attention. But I think there are a lot of interesting races going on around the country. And there's about half a dozen of them that I'm going to be watching closely in the next few months.
And that's always part of midterms. Historically, there's the obvious story of who takes control, but it often is a platform for the next round of presidential candidates, including some of the people who you didn't expect to be at the forefront. Often that's exactly what happens at midterms. So that'll be another interesting thing just to see coming out of November, both the established people like Senator Warren, but also some of these newer voices But with that, Sam, I think you should go back and get a little relaxation because you're a hard worker, and also we are out of time. So I'm glad we were able to have this conversation.
Always a pleasure.
And thanks to everyone. Once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.